the same way?
Mr. Chairman, could I make one small remark that comes off the record? You all know I'm quite dedicated to this project. It just happens that this afternoon at about 4 o'clock, the University of Oregon faculty is going to take up a resolution either to completely eliminate the reserve officers training program or to wipe out all academic credit for it. I feel extremely strongly on this subject. I'm very anxious to be there for the vote. For various reasons, perhaps I am a reserve officer. I feel incredibly strongly that this motion ought to be defeated and the ROTC ought to be kept at the University of Oregon. I feel intensely that as long as there is evil in the world, we have to have a military organization and democracy, and that it is incredibly important that a substantial block of reserve officers or officers in the military establishment be educated in liberal university environments. For this reason, I profoundly desire to keep them on the campus. I also feel that this attack is not based on curricular reasons. So much of the military training, how to retreat under fire, and intricate communication system is just as professional as curriculum in law school and the medical school. This attack on the ROTC is somewhat emotional and really strikes almost at the roots of the university. That is, if this group, for non-curricular reasons, can eliminate a given professional aspect of the university today, they can attack another institution of the university.
All right, and I would like now to make an observation to you gentlemen and to the committee. We're going to try to complete this entire code today and tonight, so that may give you some ideas to the rate you want to proceed.
Support of spouse and children. Section 103 is the opening section of this particular part. It provides essentially that the spouse and children of the deceased.
May I interrupt? Do you want this read?
No, we don't.
Provides essentially that the spouse and children of the deceased will have the right to occupy the family abode for a year. That would mean that to the extent that the estate itself has the right to occupy the abode, either through a lease or through ownership, the personal representative must let the spouse and children have the abode for a year. I think it's almost significant than that.
I would correct him in one sense. It's dependent children. That's it's changed from minor children. There could be dependent children other than minor children.
Tell us as you go through where the changes are. Substantive changes to existing law.
Well, the whole concept, Senator Wilner, of support is changed from a basis on which the property exempt from judicial execution to be set aside to what we provide here. And it should be looked as a package of the benefits we get not only in the support provisions, but the election provisions as well.
Does there have to be a surviving spouse in this community?
No, the dependent children would take their respective spouse.
I'm sure that says it. It says the spouse and the dependent child.
Well, if you look to 404, the court by order, and who may petition.
Should be or rather than and.
The reason it's and is because they expect them to live together and not to fight it.
I'm getting at. I know what you suppose. There's no surviving spouse. It depends on the child. They have a right to live there.
You might very well have this situation, but you want a guardian to live there with
them. I'm quite sure it is, and it's found in the petition provisions.
If you put the word or in, you create
see, it. 104 subdivision 1, petition therefore on behalf, buyer on behalf of the spouse or any dependent child.
Or
any dependent child in section 104, line 16. 104.
6. Or there and
then. If they're given the right to petition separately, it must mean that they're may live there separately. But if there's both a spouse and a dependent child, they have to live there together. And they live one or the other.
All I'm saying, I don't necessarily think that's support in section 104 is the same as the right to live in the home in section 103. I don't think it's stupid, if I see as it seems.
No, I kind of agree with Senator Lampfield. Section 104 does relate to support, and 103 concerns itself the occupancy of the family home.
Isn't that quite different?
Yes.
Well, we should correct that right now.
That's what I mean.
We want to make sure it's the spouse and or. We can't say and or because that's bad. The spouse, we want to make sure that the spouse is not can be dependent children.
What we're saying, Mr. Chairman, the spouse and dependent children.
Mr. Chairman, may I interject myself in here on behalf of Legislative Council? I think the meaning would be clear if you just said the spouse or instead of and. I think the meaning would be quite clear.
If what?
If you said or instead of and, I think the meaning would be quite clear, subject to what Mr. Lindsay said.
Bob?
Well, you could say the spouse or the dependent children on both.
Yes, that's it.
I think
that eliminates any problem. Mm-hmm.
And I think it should be children.
Children, it's not a child.
The spouse or any dependent children of both.
If you say any, that takes a singular child. And if you want to include your children, I think you want to do that.
I think he's right. When you say any dependent child, it's a multiple as well.
What word is it?
Senator Lent moves that on line 28, page 37, the word, second word in the second line, and be changed to or. Is there any discussion?
Well, then put or both. You have the child.
All right, or both. You've heard the motion. All in favor, say aye. No. Why, Harry? All right, pardon me for interrupting. Now we go.
Section 104, support of spouse and children.
Before you read 103, by writing into statute the words within the extended coverage provided by fire insurance policy, is this likely to have a reasonably understood meaning over a long period of years?
Certainly doesn't matter.
Yes, it does.
That's the extended coverage means the marriage policy and the fire insurance policy. That doesn't mean over a period of years.
Every year or so, they seem to change what's an extended and what's an additional extended.
John, it does require a different meaning as time goes by. The legislature should probably take care of it. I think right now, those are. I see your point.
Should I go on to section 104?
Let's all right.
We have, as you know, eliminated the concept of probate homestead, at least insofar as probate law is concerned, and the concept of property exemptions from the claims of the decedent's creditors. These exempt property concepts will, of course, continue to be enforced in the general law, but they will no longer be enforced as far as the decedent is concerned. In place of the rights which the widow has today of a certain amount of exempt property from the claims of creditors, we bring in this entirely new approach for the support of spouse and children. And what we're essentially saying is, and this one is extremely important, the court by order shall make necessary and reasonable provision from the estate of the decedent for the support of the spouse and any dependent child of the decedent upon, and the rest is essentially procedural. The spouse and dependent child will petition the court to make an award from the estate for their reasonable support. There is no absolute limitation as to the amount of property which could be set off for the support of the widow and children. It's a very far-reaching provision to
that the spouse and dependent children are provided for to the extent that the estate will suffer it and thereby not impose this burden on welfare.
Where are we now, Mr. Lundley, if we change this and to or in the preceding section and not change it here? Any problem with the interpretation?
I think not in this case.
I would emphasize that this petition and notice has to be given to interested persons before the property is set off. And in section 105, we essentially...
Excuse me, I'd like to, because of Mr. Senator Milner's question and observation a moment ago, the hearing in this instance is new concept as far as our federal law is concerned.
Yes, but maybe it's quite important because under the old law, you didn't have this hearing. We have greatly enlarged the powers of the court to set off the property, so perhaps the hearing is absolutely necessary. I would want to emphasize in section 105 certain matters which the petition must contain. The petition for support under section shall contain a description of the property, other than property of the estate, available for the support of the spouse and the children, an estimate of the expenses anticipated for their support. If the petitioner is the personal representative, the petition shall also include, so far as known, a statement of the nature and estimated value of the property. In short, we want to make it quite clear that this is a support provision based upon need, and the court is not to set off property for the spouse and children if the spouse and children, through other non-testamentary means, already have adequate support, either non-testamentary means or perhaps the independent wealth of the spouse and children. It's based upon need. Not automatic at all. Section 106 provides for temporary support. Pending hearing upon petition under 104, the court, of course, will continue to provide temporary support, and that, I think, is a benefit of the law today. And then, of course, in section 107, the support order may be modified by the court or terminated as need manifests itself. Section 108, provision for support under section 104 may consist of any one or more of the following. The court may set aside personal property from the estate or real property from the estate, just absolutely set aside property to the spouse of the dependent children, or may provide in some part C for periodic payments. And again, the court in determining the support is instructed to take into consideration the solvency of the estate, the property available for support other than the property of the estate, and any property inherited by the spouse or children. Section 109 places some rather significant limitations on the support. If it appears to the court that after the provision for support under section 104 is made, the estate will be insolvent, the provision for support ordered by the court shall not exceed one half of the estimated value of the property of the estate and any periodic payments. What we're attempting to state here is that before the court makes the support award, it should have a reasonable estimate of the total assets of the estate and the probable debts of the estate. If it appears to the court that the debts are such that the estate would in fact be thrown into insolvency, that is, that there would not be enough property in the estate to pay all the debts, then in that situation, the support for the wife and minor children, dependent children, is not to exceed one half of the estate.
Mr. Chairman, if it appears to the court that the support provision will take 3/4 of the estate, then there's no diminution in the half.
Will there be enough assets in the estate to pay all the debts?
Yes, if the support money provision takes, say, 3/4 of the estate, it's not reduced.
No.
If it takes all of it, reduced to half.
I kind of prefer to start off by figuring out what the debts are and can we pay the debts. We might very well set off 4/5 of the estate to the spouse as long as the 1/5 is enough to cover the debts.
My question, if there's not enough money to pay the debts, then you reduce the widow's and children's support to not get to 1/2.
Yes.
On the other hand, if the debts bring what I'm trying to say, it's possible the widow could get far more than a half.
Yes.
Except if it reaches the magic point where there's nothing left. Then she goes back to a half. My question is, should she go back to 3/4?
I think not, because we have to, we're trying to protect the interests of creditors. And we've just used an arbitrary fraction of 1 1/2. That's why Tom insisted upon the question of what debts, what is the status of the debt if they're all paid. She may get it all in the subsequent section, you know, she may get it 100%. But if there's to be any sharing, then the creditors will share the extent 50% if it's necessary.
Maybe phrase that if we're in a situation in which the creditors can't be paid in full, then we drop down from a magic pool to 1/2, and the creditors will be paid at least 1/2 of the estate. And the widow would get the rest. If there's to be, if we can't pay all the creditors and what the widow should get as far as support, then the whole thing drops down, and at least 1/2 of the creditors' claims would be paid, and the widow presumably would get the rest if the court felt it necessary for their support. The creditors might get more than half if the remaining half was more than was needed for her support, but they must at least have 1/2.
But on her side of the fence, she may get 3/4, because only 1/4 is necessary to meet the obligation of the creditor of the estate.
I went through this with my clients, and they have the same problem, and I hope that they've got this particular section, the same question you're asking, trouble. And I hope we've got it clear enough and settled by the fact that you asked it, may have also asked it.
1/10.
Priority of support, treated as administration expense, subject to the limitations imposed by Section 109 of this Act, provision for support has priority over claims and expenses of administration. The provision shall not be charged against the distributive share of the person receiving support, but shall be treated as an expense of administration. The essential thrust of this section is to make it clear that the widow's support is to be treated as an expense of administration, and therefore, as an expense of administration, would come before creditors' claims, except for this 1/2, which must occur.
Frankness requires that in these sessions in the state, I was in Coos Bay, for example, and this really takes gives the widow a preference over lawyers.
Yeah.
I didn't say it that, but I want the committee's attention called to it, because lawyers in the area did question it.
And there may be a more significant reason why there's nothing wrong with that, and that is what this really takes the place of the exempt property which the spouse used to get. And the exempt property was clearly free of the claims of attorneys and court costs and anything else. So it was felt in that sense to carry out the public policy set forth in the old probate exemption statutes, this would have to be treated as expensive administration.
Will this reduce the taxable estate? Will this reduce the taxes
on this. Depends what we end up with, reductions under our inheritance tax law. And generally, yes. I would expect that to be the end result, but I couldn't say until you get through the inheritance tax
law. Well, if we didn't make any changes that were not in this bill, inheritance tax law, and this is an expensive administration, I thought that generally expensive administration would be viewed as reducing the taxes.
Support is not an expensive administration.
I think the answer is that it's an expensive administration as far as priority is concerned, but it is not literally an expensive administration. I can't conceive that for tax purposes we could set off a $30,000 estate because it was necessary for the education of 8 children and elude the claims of the Internal Revenue Service and the state tax. I think it's purely stated as an expensive administration for the purposes of priority and payment.
And prior to expenses of administration in the usual sense.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to
Chairman, may I?
Because I think, isn't that right, Senator? It could possibly be an expensive administration to raise taxes.
The only reason I ask the question is line 34, shall be treated as an expensive administration.
It's a good question.
You shook us both.
Chairman.
Yes.
Maybe we better specify the purpose then.
I'm not asking for amendments, just to be agreeable, but if there's a problem, then you ought to be.
I think we're all right, don't you? Because in the lead line, we say treated as administration, subject to the limitations. Support under 104 has priority over claims and expenses of administration. It doesn't say it isn't expensive.
Senator Allison?
All the way through the code, and I think without exception, I'm sure Mr. Lundy will back me up. When we list the things that must be paid out of the estate, we state support of spouses and children and expenses of administration. They're never listed as one. They're listed entirely separate, I think, all the way through the whole code. So this separation, editorially wise, is kept up.
I think we're all right.
Mr. Chairman, could I ask the gentlemen who are so beautifully concerned with this, do they know whether anywhere in this will the word family is used?
I would say no, but Mr. Lundy could say no much better than I did.
I know that. Yeah.
I don't believe the word is used.
Suggested for 103 that I like. I think we take that. I'd rather work it out.
For most places, it would be rather just a substitute.
But if put a definition with the definition section, then it would be much easier to use this text. And also, it solves some problems with probably not providing a good step children in this idea of 103. So.
Section 111, if it appears after the expiration of 4 months after the date of the first public notice of interested persons, that reasonable provision for support of the spouse and any dependent child warrants that the whole of the estate, after payment of claims, taxes, and expenses of administration be set aside for support, the court may so order. This really, we feel, in a large block of cases, will achieve, with one short section here, most of what a small estates act would accomplish. If we have a typical estate in which there is enough money to pay creditors' claims, the creditors' claims are relatively small, a milk bill, etc., after those claims have been paid, if the judge decides that the estate is such that in the normal future events, it will require the whole estate for the support of the spouse and the dependent children through their minority and education, it will take the entire estate, you may set the estate off and terminate the estate right then.
That raises a point that I have been wondering about. Apparently, when you say sufficient provision for support or reasonable provision for support, you mean for the rest of their life expectancy of the spouse and for the minority of the child? Or what do you mean?
Minority or to go beyond. If you have a mentally retarded child or physically ill child.
But it doesn't ever say based on dependency, does it? Anywhere, did it? I just didn't notice.
Only does use the expression dependent child all the time.
Well, the child, but does that mean he's dependent at the time the estate is probated, or, you know, I mean,
as a question.
Would you like that pretty, would you like it open?
It would appear to me that most estates, if the judge says it's reasonable for them to live in the same manner as they did while the deceased spouse was living, most estates could be used. And the administration closed on this basis.
And Nancy, that's probably thinking of 104.
It's really, the provisions are really parallel to 104 in that sense.
Any questions?
I assume you intend only support during the pendency of 104, only support during the pendency of 104.
No.
You do not.
That's the key.
All right, then. if you are taking the statistical value of the support obligation, the rest of the life, that will take effect in most states that are living.
That's right. If the decedent himself has not made adequate provisions in his estate for his spouse and dependents, then the court will do it for him. This is a broad social policy concept. What the underlying concept is, and we accept it without question, that a man is responsible for the support of his wife and dependent children while he lives. And yet, under our existing statutes, a man in many situations may completely make provisions in his will which do not take care of those persons which, while he was alive, the law would require him to support.
We get a limitation in C, section 108, as payments at least. I'm not too sure, but we might place a similar limit in other respects. But C, periodic payments of money during the administration of state, but payments may not continue for more than 2 years after the date of death of the deceased.
The closest analogy of this is an English provision enacted in 1938, which gives the English courts, and it's now been exercised in many of the Commonwealth countries, Australia and New Zealand, giving the court power to set aside funds for the support, in the broadest sense, of the spouse and dependent children. This could take the dependent children through age 21, through their education, could take the spouse through her life, if the decedent had not done it.
Come back to 108C. You have payments of money, but I suppose in determining the quantity of real and personal property to be set aside, it may take into account a period longer than that if the circumstance requires it.
Support's been defined to include the transfer of title.
That's right. And the reason you have the ABC here, if the court sets aside $50,000 in stocks or sets aside $15,000 of real property, he can't very well make arrangements for periodic payments beyond the period of administration. The periodic payments are paid by the personal representative during the period of administration. Beyond that, the support takes the form of a transfer of property adequate to support the spouse and dependent children.
I think you come to this gentleman to the court by order shall make necessary and reasonable provision for support. Now, maybe the legislation ought to help the judges a little more than it does. Will they say what is a reasonable provision for support?
I don't claim to have the kind of mentality that judges have, but it seems that a lawyer could suggest to a judge that you're getting rid of dower, for instance, and that this is something, the whole scheme replaces it, so that you would be talking about the lifetime of the widow, although you wouldn't be talking about giving her everything.
What the English courts have been doing under this comparable provision, if they have a spouse that they feel is would not be able to manage property of this sort, they create a trust. The court creates a trust and transfers $50,000 in personal property to the trust company to make payments to the spouse and dependent children.
Why were the words small estates used in that caption, 111?
I think it never mind everybody's mind that Senator was we wanted to point the finger at that. And I don't think the connotation of small had any significance as such at all. Although in my own mind I think they ought to be small. I don't agree with that $50,000 myself.
But I don't see anything in here that limits this.
No, it doesn't.
That's why
I'm wondering why that word small is small estates. It's in the title to the provision, and then there's no further reference anywhere in the section.
Can I get another piece of cheap education here? In the civil law in France and in Switzerland, they have something called a legitime. Does this have any relationship to this?
No, this really represents a rejection of that concept. That's another way of going about it.
That's an automatic, irreducible share.
That takes you back to setting aside the how do we pronounce it again? Legitime is very comparable to forced share. It starts off with the concept that the wife must be able to get at least a given percentage. In the civil law, take the position that each child must be able to get at least a minimum amount, not preterminated heir, which works on the concept that the deceased may have forgotten about, so it gives him an absolute right. But
you just can't cut your children out.
Right, but the civil law operates on the ground that they have the right to whether or not they need it or not. And this takes the other view that this support will only apply if they need it. And so perhaps I shouldn't have used $50,000. Maybe it's too large. In a sense, I suppose I used it as a matter of shock so we would know exactly what we're doing here. But you could conceivably have an estate in which the widow was ill, paralysis or something, in which the expenses of her care, plus a couple of paralyzed children, could run you into a great deal of money.
Well, the reason I don't like that is because the premise is that the testator, the husband, hasn't taken care of his family. And here they'd be asking the court to do it despite his wishes, is it? And
Mr. Allison, would you agree that we need some more guidance for the court in determining what is reasonable?
Mr. Chairman, the first approach that we made on this problem, as we would have logically if we looked at other modern new codes, and of course now we have a $10,000 figure, if you remember, in our present code. My recollection is that the Washington new code talks about $50,000. I believe there are other areas in other codes. And we battle this around. Can we make a fixed figure here as a matter of guidance? And we just made up our mind, and this certainly was the thinking of Judge Dixon, that every probate problem is different, every support problem is different, and broad discretion should be given to the judge, who will now have all of the estate assets, non-probate and probate, disclosed. I also might talk about small estates. Of course, the caption, everyone knows, is not a part of the act.
I realize that, but I don't think it should mislead anyone either, and that's what this is doing, in my opinion.
We had constant questions as to whether we had any provision for both small estates, and I think that probably is the explanation.
They're doing it.
Maybe misleading.
I've had the small states act in before. You're doing a political job there. Small is an undefined word in the statute.
It doesn't do violence to the section 11 to eliminate that and begin with setting apart the PR.
I think section's probably all right. That's the only thing I find wrong with it.
Mr. Chairman, could I go back to line 17 on page 39? Could it be said that periodic payments could not be limited to more than 2 years, but would the state have to remain open? Periodic payments during administration of the state. Does that mean that the state has to remain open?
Under 111, that estate could be closed after the order had been made. You make the order to make, say, give them $400 a month for 2 years, and then you go over here and you find out that 4 months have passed and there wasn't any contest, you go ahead and close the estate, and it would just be subject to that order, I suppose.
But I would say, in answer to your question, as I read this, that if these payments are going to continue for a period of up to 2 years, under section 108, the state must remain open.
That's your interpretation?
That would be my interpretation.
They can only be during administration.
I was an error.
But if the administration goes beyond 2 years, they have to cut off then.
You can still go back to the next.
Okay.
To this other section. Worry whether line 17 and 11 accomplish anything.
Okay, what?
May I ask another question? In these cases where death occurs, an administrator is appointed solely for the purpose of commencing wrongful death action, and 10, 20, whatever amount is obtained, then under 111, there shall be no further proceedings and the estate shall be summarily closed. Under 111, would that estate be closed? I would assume so. Assume no claim.
And assume the recovery is distributed.
Yeah.
I'm glad to see that because Eugene in Lane County, you know, they just won't close the state until they get the last publication and everything else.
So this would be helpful in that area.
They even are demanding tax releases down there.
Yeah, I'll say. May I ask a question? How does the committee feel about the word small estate? Motion's been made that on line 1, page 40, the words small estates and the colon be deleted, that the title commence with setting apart, with the first S being made a capital. Any discussion? Those in favor will say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion is carried.
Part 2 then is the elective share of the surviving spouse. And the elective share under the new code is 1/4 of the value of the net estate of the decedent. Now the elective share is 1/4 of the net estate, and the only significant change, of course, is that that's includes real and personal property. It's 1/4 of the entire estate. But here is the significant change. But the elective share shall be reduced by the value of the following property given to the surviving spouse under the will of the decedent. And then you have a long list of property which the decedent, which the surviving spouse might have received under the will of the decedent. And then in subsection 2, except as to property applied under subsection 1 of this section to reduce the election to take under the section forfeits any other right to take under the will. I think it's in section 114 that we maybe get the significant interplay. Section 114 says elective share limited by total property received. We start off with the notion that the wife will have an elective share of 1/4 of the net estate. And then going over to 114, the surviving spouse may not receive by election under section 112 of this act any amount which, together with any of the following property received by him, exceeds 1/2 of the total of the following property, such property to be reduced by the amount of federal estate tax. And this long list then of property essentially encompasses what we loosely think of as non-probate assets, or another, Mr. Allison gets mad at me every time I say this, but that property which we customarily think of as part of the federal taxable estate as a part of the probate estate. Probably the three larger items would be section 114C, proceeds of insurance on the life of the decedent. E, trust property. And I can't see it right away, joint tenancy property. What our thinking was is that we very often have a situation today in which a large percentage of a man's economic wealth passes to his spouse through non-testamentary transfers, insurance proceeds, joint tenancy property, or perhaps the proceeds of an inter vivos trust. If he has adequately taken care of his wife through these methods and leaves his testate property, let's say, to a brother, or a child, we don't want the wife to be able to take an elective share of 1/4 of his probate estate if she's already been abundantly taken care of through non-probate assets. So for purposes of the 1/4, we in a sense look at all of these non-probate transfers. And if hypothetically we added his probate estate, we added his probate estate together with all of these non-probate assets, and if of this amalgamated pot, she has already got over 1/2 of his substantive economic wealth, then she would not get the elective share at all.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman.
The money or property that she gets under 104, which language is that? Net estate.
That's already taken out. It's the net estate.
112 is net estate, and that's not a net estate because that's treated as an expense of administration.
She's already got it.
When did she make the election? It's later on. This is unlike the existing law in that she takes the property under the will. We start with that. It says that 9 days after the motion, 3 days after the inventory, she makes the money. Right now, at this
time,
at that point, will it be known at that point how much money is going to get into the and the children for the rest of their lives as a matter of support. I assume any of them probably
doesn't make any difference.
Well, I mean, under 104, you're saying that assuming the man dies with his young children, 104 is going to take almost all of the state anyway.
Fine.
But the question is, at what point is it going? Are you saying that 104 will have to be adjudicated prior to 90 days after the date of admission of the well, or 30 days after the date of the filing of the inquiry check is late? Otherwise, she's going to be electing against something which is not clear what it is.
Yes, so in the existing law, your petition for support was only after the filing inventory. That's been removed. And I can see there could be some conflict if somebody didn't pay attention to it. But if someone is paying attention to it, they could have it resolved before this was occurred.
No, you're defining net estate for these folks tonight. The question really is, do you know what the net estate is going to be after you determine, after taking out all the support money at this point?
I'm trying to answer by saying that if you're administering this estate, you would be aware of the need to correlate with its identity. And you would get some done.
Yes, sir.
That's my understanding.
And you're going to win a statutory election. Or let's assume whichever these 2 days is later, the petition of support has not yet been determined.
He's saying you don't know what the net estate is until you get that resolved.
He's saying technically it doesn't make any difference.
In order to determine, and maybe I'm wrong, but in order to determine whether or not he'll elect against the will, what the spouse really has to know is what provision is made for her under the will and what is probably going to be the estate.
But under 104, we're talking about 10 children. I'm raising the 10 to public under this section against the 10 children in 104.
I think it could be just
the widow is an absolute right. She can just say, as of this date, I want to get this much.
She hasn't pursued it. Well, that's what's created the conflict. The minute the estate is in court, she can petition for that support.
Yes.
Now, she's got to tell tonight, she's got 30 days after the filing of the inventory, that is the latest date for making the election. Maybe we ought to make provision for court having authority to
114
additional time. So
I'm worried about children, not her. I mean, she can protect she can protect herself by her options.
How would her right to elect to respect the children's support under 104?
If let's postulate that she elects on election day under 168. 1/4 the net estate. She's got it.
Okay. Suppose the children, the net estate. We don't get the net estate until we've taken care of the dependent children. All she can elect is what's left over after the support. Therefore, I don't see how her election could be affected by the support. And it's tactically, I don't see how her decision.
All right, you're saying she can make the election on election day, but she won't get it until the closing probate.
Right, and her election can only operate against that part of the estate which is left for distribution after the expenses.
All right, well, turn it around. Then, by this, required to make an election before she knows what her options are. Because she doesn't know what the dependent children are going to get.
Right. What difference is that? No, I don't think it can affect her money at all. Whatever she and the children get by way of support is going to come before we have arrived at that net estate. It would come out of her, in a sense, come out of what she might take under a will. Yet, if the court sets off a substantial amount of property for the dependent children, it might, in fact, impinge upon what she would otherwise have taken under the will.
Well, I think we saw what I'm getting. Nobody else makes any call.
Have I answered it, though?
No.
The support is going to come first. She's got to decide which takes care of her the best, the will or the elective share. And both the will and the elective share would be equally susceptible to being cut down by support. As her election, really, is where am I best off? Under the provisions that the will makes for me or under the elective share? Which is best? What he gave me under the will or what the law gives me by way of the elective share? Both of those could be affected. And then it seems to be the same way by what the court does under 104. And what the court does under 104 is applies equally to the risk she takes under either the legal collection. Am I coming through at all? Or?
No,
yes, yes, you are. Loud and clear.
Go ahead.
Next section. Senator Wilner, are you satisfied with your...
No, but if the rest are, that's fine. I'll reread it between now and 7:30.
Let me reread it again, too, because I'm just playing it off.
But what you mean while going to the next section?
I skipped section 113, election barred by agreement. They can, the spouse and the husband can agree to bar it. Section 115, we've got some provisions here to deny the election in a situation where the deceased and the surviving spouse are already living apart.
Court may deny.
Yes, to give the court discretion. Any question on that?
Yeah, it occurs to me that there's two ways you can be living apart.
The way I am the last 2 days, for example.
It's a legislative film, really.
This doesn't doesn't have the judge finding anybody at fault for the separation
no.
fact or anything of that kind, but as a matter of fact, let's assume the man wants to do his wife out of her share, and he knows that his will is helpful along this line, and he wants to keep her from electing against the will, he can move out of the house. Now, he has to do that sort of in contemplation of death, but...
The
suicide.
Well, he might even have a novel way to do that. But if you read the beginning on 25, the court in deciding what elective share, if any, should be granted, shall consider the length of the marriage, whether the marriage was a first or subsequent marriage, or either or both of the spouses, the contribution of the surviving spouse, the property of the deceased, the form of service, the transfer of property, the length and cause of the separation, and any other relevant circumstances.
Well, all right, we're talking about the cause of the separation and the scoundrel, naturally the husband, who has moved out on his wife. Is dead. Of course, the burden is always going to be on her, and if there are ever cases that develop, the typical case is going to be one where the wife says, I was generous and modest and did all things for meat and profit, but does stay out all night and drink, so he's not getting something apart.
I suppose when we wrote this, we were thinking of the opposite.
I'm sure you were.
The one in which the wife is going off with a French circus performer. And we wanted to put something in so that the elective share would not be automatic in all cases. There might be some circumstances in which the wife was the scoundrel, and it would not seem to accord with our sense of fair play and justice that she'd get the elective share. And beyond that, trying to isolate wrong and in which cases she would not be entitled to it, we felt that the only viable solution, if you wanted to go this route at all, that is to not make it automatic, was to leave it up to the judge.
Yes. I'm going to quietly suggest that this section has a court under the rug.
That comment might have been more apt over at 104.
Well, that's another place over there. I've talked about it when we got to where you were settling the state after you had measured the support of argument.
Here's not so much, you know, he's already, in a sense, made a will, which presumably we're not going to be concerned with the elective share unless the will gave her less than what the elective share would give her. He's already made his will, and the law would remake the will for him. The elective share is the law remaking his will.
Well, now that's true, and we can tell what that is, and a lawyer can tell him what the result will be.
She'll
get this or she'll get this. You can't look at this and say, now look, George, she'll get this or get this.
Aren't we really saying, we start off that with the elective share, the law has made a will for a man that he clearly did not want to make. The elective share is always something we're imposing upon a kicking and screaming testator. He didn't want to give his wife a 1/4, or else the elective share would not come into being. So here, we're really saying that in these few cases, the judge will be permitted to say that the will which the law has made for the testator is not.
The Judge Dickerson, his oft-repeated comment, or this is the essence of it, is, so how often would this happen? And this code is premised on the fact, on the basis that the unusual, and maybe that will happen, but this is better to have the overall problem treated this way.
I think that on the basis of our present affluence and our attitudes about these things, it will happen much more frequently that people simply don't bother to get it. Maybe older people don't have much reason to, they just don't bother.
How much violence will be done to this proposed code if we do one of two things? Number one, define this only where there is legal separation, so that you don't get into this problem. Or number two, deleting all of section 115.
I don't think it will define only where there is.
Mr. Chairman, on that, we received numerous comments, and there were strong comments criticizing this particular section in the sense that they say this is the kind of thing that should be determined by the court at the time that you decree a legal separation. You should have the court decide these questions at this time and not make a decision on the question of the elective share. And,
I
just quote the criticism.
So do you want to decree or do you want to complain for legal separation?
I would think a decree. Maybe you'd be right. But we eliminate a lot of arguments, and it may be that in the future our attitude towards marriage and everything may change to the point where it's Ed suggests they are simply living apart without any formal procedure or agreement of any kind, whatever. But when that time arrives, there will be legislatures here to reconsider this thing.
I'm not ready to make a motion on it yet, Mr. Chairman, but I do want to flag it. I want to think about it for a while. The thing that bothers me the most is that the only way that I could advise a client what his rights were and his responsibilities and what would happen, regardless of which side of this he's on, would be to say, well, if all of the property is settled in some other fashion before the death of the first spouse, then it's taken care of. In other words, if you dispose of it some other way, then that's the only way you can have certainty here. Even there,
you question your Bible on trust?
There's a couple of places where trust seems to be pushed.
I'm right to
this really pushes the other way, doesn't it?
Committee, this was copied or taken, I don't know the copy, from Wisconsin probate, and their comment is this. This section is new and changes the existing law. The inequity of allowing the election where the surviving spouse has deserted the decedent during lifetime should be obvious. The existing law allows even an adulterous widow to claim dower. The difficulty, however, of providing a fixed rule for separated couples has led to the proposed section which would vest discretion in the court to deal with individual cases on the basis of all available facts. In some cases of separation, no right to elect should be given. In others, a full elective share is proper. In still others, a reduced share would be consistent with the facts. The judicial burden should not be great since the number of cases will be few. And the issues are no more troublesome than a property division in a contested divorce. The presence of this section should operate to deter election in many instances where the surviving spouse might otherwise elect. The phrase living apart is designed to mean more than physical separation. Thus, the section would not apply merely because an elderly husband or his wife was in a nursing home while the other spouse resided elsewhere.
For example, that's section 6. But, Mr. Chairman, there was one part of that comment that I think one could quibble with, and that is that the issues are no more difficult than in the contest for divorce itself. Both parties are able to present their case properly there, and one party is dead in the sentence.
Well, I personally don't regard it as an important provision, whether it's in or out.
All right. I think we better move on to the section.
Section 116, what constitutes election? This is really procedural, and I don't think substantially changes the present law. Section 117, election by guardian of surviving spouse, an election under section 112 may be filed on behalf of an incompetent surviving spouse by a guardian of the spouse.
Line 14, do you want prior notice instead of notice? Certainly, other interested persons want to find out what thereafter happened. And one other question. First of all, I have two questions. Well, one is whether I assume you mean without their being notified so they can be there. Then the second question, if you're defining the category of people as interested persons, do those interested persons have an appeal right, even though they were not there?
I would think not.
But you set up a class called interested persons, the persons affected by the law.
Are we really saying here that the court's right to determine whether or not it will permit election does not require notice of interested persons? Well, why should it?
No,
that's exactly what you're saying. Yeah.
Well, my first question was, I assume they're going to get later notice. I assume you meant without notice before the hearing. My second, that's why I suggested the word prior. My second question is, if you're by statute defining a class of persons being interested, and of course you mean persons whose share will be diminished,
or creditors,
are you established?
No, nobody shares.
It's not their share.
We're right back. We don't get to this problem at all until we determine that estate after we pay the creditors.
But then, if you define as interested, aren't you raising a due process problem?
I just don't see your point at all, to be honest. Because all it's saying is that this can be done, it's subject to the court's approval. You could have said without giving notice here, but if the court wants to give notice in that particular case, he can.
There's nothing he can do about it. All right, then, if the county judge makes a termination under 115, is it appealable?
I wouldn't think so.
I know. I mean, not to anyone, not to the circuit court, not even by the widow who was denied her full share.
Why wouldn't that be appealable?
I was thinking, Mr. Love, these people didn't come in.
Let me say, Chairman, I certainly answered the senator's question. Those counties where the probate jurisdiction is in the county court, it's in the county court. There isn't anything that county court does that can't be retried by the circuit court to be appealed.
All right, now let's go to circuit court. Suppose it's done in a circuit court county. Is 115 appealed?
I would say if there's any justiciable issue there, likewise, the trying can be appealed and can be carried further, yes.
All right, then the next question is, can it be appealed by anybody other than the surviving spouse who sought the election?
I would assume that it could be appealed by any interested party.
Well,
all right, well, then my question, going back to my original question, if it can be appealed by any interested party, which is also my assumption, you're defining a hearing here, which you say an interested party need not be there.
Well, I'm assuming any interested party would maybe appear or something.
Well, I mean, how's the interested party going to know about the party? Now, the answer that I got to all my questions Monday is covered elsewhere in the Act. If it is, forgive me. But don't you have a problem?
I'm not prepared to answer because I don't remember the others. And this is the same as saying the other elsewhere. But I'm firm in my knowledge and memory of this, that we want finality. We've provided finality to a number of things in this situation. And maybe I better stop talking until I search for them. But I don't know.
My first response would be, I don't see any sense in distinguishing between county and circuit courts.
I agree.
Your question.
No question.
Go on from there. My second question or observation would be that if the spouse seeks to elect and has been denied, she would clearly have the right to appeal. In the normal situation, that is, the elective sheriff would think of it today, there couldn't be anyone really who would have, that we would have to characterize as interested other than the spouse. She has an absolute right to elect to take the chair today, and there isn't, the court doesn't have any discretion really there.
At the present, I agree.
Yeah. I'm really leading up to agreeing with you. Now we've changed that, and under some circumstances, the spouse might be denied her election, and whether or not she's denied, it can be very important to somebody else with an interest in the estate, some other beneficiary under the will. If she's denied the election and appeals, then the election was probably denied because some other person interested in the estate opposed her.
And
they
were
interested in opposing her on appeal just as they were interested there. Yeah, maybe they aren't going to know.
Or alternatively, you can't define those interested parties who are not given notice.
Excuse me, Don.
Mr. Allison. Well, the only reason why this section is in the code at all is the fact that where you have an incompetent spouse who has a guardian appointed to order, the guardian always has an ethical problem regardless of the circumstances, whether he might be blamed for dereliction of his duty as a guardian if he does not ask as much as he could for the spouse. And it was really to resolve that ethical problem for a guardian of incompetence that this was put in. This gives the guardian a right to not get the election if certain circumstances which you said of exist. And also, if he does ask, he has the option to go to the court and have it part of nine. It has nothing to do with, of course, the competence, but the perfect right or the duty of the guardian to come and ask on behalf of an incompetent. And that is the whole thrust of the
Mr. Chairman, I agree with Sam that where this sentence is placed, it applies only to the problem of the guardianship. I still remain with my other question as to at least the proponents ought to be in agreement as to three questions. Whether the discretionary determination of the judge in either county or circuit is appealable from 115, and if it is appealable by whom, and if it is appealable by persons other than the surviving spouse, are they entitled to some notice of the proceeding? I think those two ought to involve one way or the other.
Supposing in this section that you would stop, and we're talking about section 112, you would stop and simply set an election in section 112 of this act, and that means everything in it, may be filed on behalf of the incompetent surviving spouse by a guardian of the spouse, period. No, and then not first sentence in 117. Yeah, just have one period.
That would solve that problem. The other problems.
Well, it would solve the others too, because it's the remaining language that creates all of the other problems.
No, I stand corrected by Stan Allison that this deals only with guardianship.
It does.
You still have the problems I've been raising, but they were 115. Or the three questions that I just put to Stan, can you recollect whether we survived or appealed from any such order as this?
We didn't provide any specific appeals on specific sections. We did incorporate, in fact, the present appeal of law that we have now, that we do have a situation where the ordinary rules of appeal apply. The same right of appeal is given to the probate court as is now given to circuit courts. Now, that's a very
scholarly
answer to your question.
I think it does.
Well, you get a contradiction there, some sort of question, Mr. Chairman, because later on we find that you have a certain period of time in which to object to the final account, and that's it, period. And we close off a good many claims, and we make the determination final. I haven't put this together, sir, so I can answer. Secondly,
yeah.
I mean, I can change to that.
More suggestions.
Change.
Yeah. All right. Section 118 merely, in substance, provides for a pro rata abatement of devises to supply the elected chair. You start off and you first use the intestate property for the elected chair. But once the intestate property is exhausted, then because of the very large impact which the elective share is likely to make against an estate, all devisees prorate to make up the elective share. And the same thing in a creditor heir situation. Part 3, title and possession of property. I get you. Section 119, and this is fairly important, within this code and throughout this code, there is no distinction between real and personal property. That is, the rules which would be applicable whenever we use the word property, it applies to both real and personal property. I can't think of anywhere in the code where we have any distinction.
Pardon me for interrupting, but we've done that.
Oh, okay. Ad nauseum. And why they put that in two separate clauses still?
I just
want
to be one.
It would be just property.
What are you seeing?
Page 39, 14 and 15. For some reason, it's separate in there.
It really ought to be transfer of title to property. Devolution of title to property. This simply vests title to the decedent's property, real and personal, in the heirs and devisees, subject to support of spouse and children, spouse's elective share, rights of creditors, and administration and sale of the personal representative. Uh,
Section 121, possession and control of the deceased estate. Here, we wanted to make it clear that the personal representative has the right to take possession and control of the estate, but that he would not be required to take possession or be accountable for a property which was already in the possession of an heir or devisee unless, in his opinion, it was necessary for purposes of administration. Now, some property might already be in the hands of an heir or devisee, and where there would be no need for him to actually reduce it to possession and control, we didn't want to impose a useless act. Duties and powers of personal representatives. Section 21.22, the duties and powers of the personal representative commence upon the issuance of his letters. His powers, however, relate back in time to give his acts occurring prior to appointment the same effect as those occurring thereafter. Also, a personal representative can ratify and accept acts on behalf of the estate done by others where the acts wouldn't have been proper for the personal representative. It's kind of a housekeeping measure to make certain that, because it would be impossible to appoint a personal representative 1 minute after the testator dies, and this covers the situation. Section 123, in a sense, connotes one of the basic theoretical concepts in the code. A personal representative is a fiduciary who is under a general duty to and shall collect the income from the property of the estate in his possession, preserve, settle, and distribute the estate in accordance with the terms of the will as expeditiously and with little sacrifice of value as is reasonable under the circumstances. It's just a general statement of what the personal representative really is supposed to do. Section 124 is more specific on the point. He shall proceed with the administration, settlement, and distribution of the estate without adjudication, order, or direction of the court, except as otherwise provided in the act. However, a personal representative or any interested person may apply to the court for authority, approval, or instructions on any matter concerning the administration, settlement, or distribution of the estate, and the court may, with or without hearing, instruct the personal representative. What we're essentially saying here, and we'll see it as I cover a couple of sections coming later on, the personal representative is a fiduciary. He is given very broad authority under this code to act in management of the property of the estate in much the same way that the trustee of an express trust acts. He is supposed to go ahead and carry out his authorities without going to court for intermediate orders until he really needs them. The basic idea is that with this broad authority, he's a fiduciary with the powers of a trustee. In the vast majority of the states, he can make the management value judgments without specific court direction, and will go ahead and do so. On the other hand, we want the court to be available to the personal representative or any interested person to adjudicate any potential act of the personal representative when anybody wants a court adjudication. The notion here is that the judge in the circuit court or the probate judge will be reserved to grant judicial decisions where somebody wants them, not just to go down and get a court order every time you want to do something, even though you have no question that it's desirable and nobody else questions it. Section 125, naming or appointing personal representative does not discharge claim against him. This is pretty standard out there.
Can you explain the words? He is liable for the claim as for so much money in his hands at a time.
May I try to answer that question? This tender is a very technical question, and you'll find that the comment in the textbook by Jaragian Love on this thing goes back to some very technical common law business, which I try to set out in my footnotes. If you read the comment, you can understand that I congratulate you. This is present law, and there's apparently a legal reason for it.
Well, is this the language that exists in the present law?
Yes, it's language which is received the annotation.
Except that we've changed the method of the procedure. We have two outlets for a claim of a personal representative, and we've simply provided one. But this language, if I was, I'm looking for it. I think it's the same.
Can I ask Jaragian or Love, whichever one is present, how that language means?
I was looking at something else under what section was it?
Page 45, line 9 to 10. He is liable for the claim as for so much money in his hands at the time the claim became due and payable. I'm not quarreling, I understand what you mean. If we're rewriting a probate code that we can't understand, how do we expect others to?
Do you have your notes?
I refer to the quotation from Merrill.
I suggest you go on to this. Mr. Drake, you're up to part of the process.
Well, 126, it's obvious, I think. Section 127. Except as restricted or otherwise provided by the will or by court order, a personal representative acting reasonably to the benefit of interested persons is authorized to. And there follows almost two full pages of transactions with the property of the decedent's estate, which the personal representative is authorized to do. That is, he can do all of these things without getting a court order, unless an interested person has come into court and got a preliminary order from the court directing that he not exercise these authorizations without a court order. It is set up for the vast majority of the states in which there isn't any dissension, and it permits the personal representative to go ahead and manage the estate very much as a trustee of an express trust.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
This is the first one that the State Welfare Commission had reference to, and that is...
Right. Now, would you please state your name and address?
William Dobson. I'm the manager of the Estate Administration Department of the State Welfare Commission.
And Mr. Dobson has suggested that one section 127, sub 1, be amended in such a manner so that we would retain the language that is in the present code, which reads, the additional language would be, provided no funeral charges except those necessary to give the decedent a plain and decent burial shall be allowed out of the estate where the assets are not sufficient to satisfy the claim of the State Public Welfare Commission and of the Board of Control. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. The Board of Control is not in our present statute, but I have consulted with them on this, and they desire to be thrown the same parity as the State Welfare Commission. Although they do not have as many estates as we have, it still would affect them to some degree. I might state that we have maintained our 700 estates all the time, and we are dealing with most of the attorneys throughout the state. And quite often, an excessive funeral bill can wipe us out. And presently, under the statute, we have a little slip. We send in our claim, and we ask them to please abide by Judge Dixon's statement that $750 is a reasonable amount from an insolvent estate, where the State Public Welfare Commission will not do this claim paid in full.
I don't think you've heard this code any. That in there at all.
It's my understanding that he thinks a plain burial is a $750 or less burial.
Well, that's a plain and decent burial, according to welfare people, is about $750.
Well, not really. It's only $400 for the welfare standards. I believe the state landlord is around $400 too. But we've consulted with Judge Dixon on this, and he has set this figure for us, which we've used throughout the state. Which I don't think is too unreasonable.
All right. How does the committee feel about that? I think the language is well.
It costs any more than that, you should.
Well, Mr. Chairman, most of the time the burial has already been taken care of before anybody's appointed.
Well, that's true, but really we don't run into too many problems on it. Lots of times the funeral directors will attempt to get away with a $1,200 burial when actually it really worth maybe $750 or less. And when we send this notice with our claims, I always talk to the attorney about it, and he said, well, I tell him, of course, that we may object to the allowance of the funeral claim as being excessive due to the circumstances of the deceased. And usually we can always get this thing ironed out to where it's a reasonable figure, around $750, maybe $850 or something. We're not hard-nosed about allowing for a headstone or something like that.
May I ask another question? Isn't it true that most of the estates you're involved in are estates where there is real property?
Yes.
And so that the question has to do with priority of disbursement of the proceeds from real property. If somebody had already paid a relative or somebody had already made a payment, they might be a little hung up. But this
that does happen occasionally, but generally we work it out one way or the other with the administrator or the attorney with the state.
And one other comment,
they have paid more.
And one other comment, Mr. Chairman. All of them lay under our existing law, and I don't know how far we've gone in changing that. The matter of the approval of that expenditure must be approved by the court, all of them.
Well, that's true in the final accounting, yes, in the final accounting approval. But if we can take care of the matter at the onset, then we have no problems coming in and finding objections to the final accounting.
They're not problems.
I think that language should be added, so move.
Motion has been made that this language, which is in the present law, be added to subsection 1 of section 127, page 45.
Would you include the Board of Control in that also?
Well, that's a different section. I was going to ask you to comment on that in a minute. Oh, and include the Board of Control.
Yes, as far as this part of it.
Well, this has the Board of Control, the language
yes.
that you have.
Well, but the present statute
does. I realize that, but this amendment has.
Yes.
Question. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Carried. And Mr. Dobson, while you're here, let's turn this, then you will have to come back. 176. And we have the same situation here. And Mr. Dobson has an amendment wherein he suggests, and this language that he has provided. If the State Public Welfare Commission, its authorized agent, or the Board of Control, or its authorized agent, has satisfied its claim pursuant to Chapter 11 to 417 Oregon Revised Statutes, or ORS 17.620 sub 3, against the estate, and the claim has not been settled or paid in full, the personal representative shall deliver to the State Public Welfare Commission or the Board of Control a copy of the final account at the same time and manner for service of notice as provided in subsection 1 of 176. Now, this, again, is present law. Is the Board of Control added here?
No, sir, it isn't.
This is the present law.
The present law of the Board of Control is not there.
Well, that's what I say.
Oh, yes, sir. It's not there.
This is the present law, except we add the Board of Control.
That is correct. And this is real important because of the length of time, 20 days, we would have no opportunity to file any objections to final accounts where quite often the general creditors are given preference to our seventh preferred claim, inadvertently, of course.
How much money do you handle a year?
We handle a little over $1 million by annum. So a little over half a million a year that we collect through the estates of deceased recipients.
That's a substantial item.
Yes, sir, I feel it, yes.
And I'd like to have him ask why he thinks that the agency would not come under C of 176. Each creditor does not receive payment in full.
Well, that's just for the notice. So I'm thinking of final accounting.
That's what I'm talking about.
Well, C refers just to the notice that's provided in one.
You recognize you'd get the note.
Right. We would get
and
the
you'd note. Then be in a position of anybody else to make an objection to the final account.
Well, if we don't have the final accounting, we couldn't very well know what to object to. We have so many estates throughout the state. That
because they are out in the states. Yeah, yeah.
It would increase the administrative costs.
I understand that.
If each creditor was not received payment, if they've already received payment, they wouldn't get the notice at all. If they do receive the notice, it's because they haven't been paid.
Okay. And that's right. Now he says, how would we know where the final account provided? Because we've got them all over the state.
He's not satisfied with that provision. Yes. He recognized that they would give him notice, but that doesn't that's satisfy him.
They want a copy of the final account in the event that they haven't been paid. Right. And I think probably so.
Mr. Chairman, may I ask you a question?
Yes.
I understand that the suggestion is really to just include the present provision in this.
Yeah, with the addition of the Board of Control, that's the only difference, yes.
The Board of Control, of course, will they have to have a judgment in order to come under this provision?
My understanding is no. The claim that the Board of Control filed, yes, it has to be an award by a court, which is unpaid award by a court, which in those cases they file their claim.
I was unaware of whether the language made it clear that it was the unpaid award made by the court. That's all.
Well, this would only pertain to those states where the claim is filed.
All right. Don, do you intend your husband moves the addition of this language?
I will.
Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor will say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion is carried. We will return to 128.
Personal representative has the same rights to perfect a lien or security interest as the deceased would have had if he were living. There's nothing more related to that. Section 129.
You can tell generally what it does.
Okay. Power to sell, mortgage, and lease. A personal representative has power to sell, mortgage, lease, or otherwise deal with property of the estate without notice, hearing, or court order. This is really very important, and it we start off, remember back in 127, we discussed all of the things which a personal representative was authorized to do. Many of the list of authorizations in Section 127 can be deleted either by the will or by a court order. The will might say that the personal representative shall not vote certain securities that I have, or a court order might direct that the personal representative not do many of these things. But in Section 129, the personal representative has the power to sell, mortgage, or lease the property of the estate. He doesn't have to get to give notice, he doesn't have to hold a hearing, doesn't have to get a court order to sell, mortgage, or lease the property of the estate. Subsection 2, on the other hand, exercise of this power is improper except after notice, hearing, and order if, and then we have three exceptions, the sale is in contravention to the will, or the property is specifically devised and the will doesn't authorize the sale of the specific property, or a bond has been required and the sale price will exceed $5,000 and the personal representative has not increased his bond to cover this amount.
Mr. Chairman, may I repeat again?
Yes.
These three exceptions, and I say this for the benefit of one who didn't hear me at the earlier hearing, these three exceptions are put in at the instance and request of the title company. They need to, in these cases, they felt they needed to have some kind of a watchdog provision so that if they get one of these situations, they would have a right to require that these things be done before they go ahead and insure on the real estate transaction. That was the basis of it. But otherwise, I might say that with these three provisions, they are going to go along with what
they have to do. And I think some members of the bar were worried about this provision. They were not talking about that.
Section 1, court order for sale, mortgage, or lease. Upon proof satisfactory to the court by an interested person that a sale, mortgage, or lease is required, and the personal representative has failed to act, the court may order the personal representative to make a sale. We start off with the presumption that the personal representative is authorized and has power to make sales. Under certain circumstances, he may be unwilling to do so when interested persons feel that he ought to. This is to specifically make clear that the court can order the personal representative to make a sale of the property where it's needed in these circumstances. Perhaps it's not necessary. Way back over in section 124, where we ordered the personal representative to act without court order, we also included a right of any interested person to come in and get a court order requiring the personal representative to do something. Now, perhaps these two provisions overlap to some extent, but we felt that in 130 it makes it quite emphatic that the personal representative can be required to do these things. Section 131, title conveyed free of claims of creditors. Property sold, mortgage, or leased by a personal representative is subject to liens and encumbrances against the decedent or his estate, but is not subject to rights of creditors of the decedent or liens, encumbrances, I think is fairly evident. The property sold is subject to whatever liens and encumbrances were upon it all the time. Section 132, sale or encumbrance to personal representative, avoidable exceptions. These are some very technical situations governing those few situations in which a personal representative wants to deal with himself. Should I go through those or? No, I don't have any questions. Validation of certain sales. The following are the subject of validating acts. I'm not really familiar with this.
They were put in the
number. Provision of existing law, which had to be amended to get it in the probate code, and merely adds a reference to the section laws where the validating act for an act section law, section laws were never compiled. It's merely an ease of reference provision that's been in the probate code for years.
Can I pass over those? Section 134, this also I believe is taken from our existing law. A transfer agent or a corporation transferring its own securities incurs no liability to any person by making a transfer of securities in the state as requested or directed by a personal representative. This is the first of two sections which are probably extremely important in the code in terms of eliminating a great deal of the expense which we now have in probate administration. If we can make it clear that a personal representative has power to make sales, even though in some circumstances he may be exercising this power without authority, then we make it much more difficult for persons dealing with a personal representative to act without long, tedious back-checking into his authority. And this is this non-liability of transfer agents. I believe it's in our law in other areas, isn't it?
No,
Uniform Stock Transfer Act, I believe it picks up the same concept. Well, this particular one, but it doesn't parallel the Uniform Stock Transfer Act that we already have, which makes it possible for a transfer agent to act upon an order from the personal representative without going all the way back into the estate proceedings, the will, etc., to be absolutely certain that the personal representative had authority to make the transfer. Enormously simplifies the administration of the state.
If the transfer agent will win.
Yes. They pretty much do now, in my understanding. Section 135 carries forward the same concept, but in a little bit broader way. A person dealing with or assisting a personal representative without actual knowledge that the personal representative is improperly exercising his power is protected as if the personal representative properly exercised the power. What we're really saying is that once the person dealing with the personal representative, purchasing property would be the classic example, has seen copies of the personal representative's letter that he is the personal representative of the estate, then the personal representative can deal at face value with that, then the third person can deal at face value with that personal representative without going back all through the will in the estate proceedings to make absolutely certain that the personal representative is not exceeding his authority. What we're really trying to do here is permit third parties to deal with a personal representative just as they would deal with you or I. They have to check and make certain that the title is clear. They don't have to check all the way back through and read the will and interpret the will. 136. However, improper exercise of power. If the exercise of power by a personal representative in the administration of an estate is improper, he is liable for breach of his fiduciary duty to interested persons for any resulting damage or loss, just as a trustee of an express trust. Exercise of power in violation of a court order is a breach of duty. Exercise of power contrary to the provision of the will may be a breach of duty. There's a slight difference here. But the notion is, and this may be relevant to go back to section 129, where we said the personal representative has a power to sell, mortgage, or lease the property of the estate. But he's not authorized to exercise that power unless he raises the bond. If he has exercised his power without getting a court order where subsection 2 of section 129 would require him to do so, then he would automatically be liable to the estate for any loss that had followed from that. He acts at his peril, and we very often have situations in which, in our present law, and where a trustee, if he acts in exercise of his authority and loss results, even though the loss resulted from the depression of 1929,